Hello and welcome to Ohio Folklore. I'm your host, Melissa Davies. Today, we're exploring the forgotten history of one of Ohio's most storied correctional institutions, the Ohio Penitentiary. Although it was torn down in 1998, it looms large in Ohio history. It once stood in a downtown neighborhood of Columbus, now known as the Arena District. Perhaps you've been there, after a Blue Jacket hockey game, wandering through the multi-story garage, trying to remember where you parked your car. Perhaps you heard the disembodied screams of men and the distinct smell of something burning. Perhaps you brushed it off as a group of troublemakers out of sight, out for a night on the town. Or instead, perhaps you've lived where the prison buildings once stood, in one of the condominium units that now run along McPherson Park. Perhaps you've stopped wondering how important household items kept getting misplaced. Perhaps you attributed those strange bumps in the night to rowdy neighbors and the endless sounds of the city. Today, the Arena District is a trendy, commercialized, modern living space. Few are aware that the ground they are trotting is stained with the blood and tears of countless anguished souls. For centuries, these few blocks, between Neal Avenue and West Street, and Spring Street north to the railroad tracks, have witnessed traumatic deaths on a massive scale. I'm talking infectious epidemics, riots, executions, and a catastrophic fire that would entrap and kill hundreds. It's a tragedy still known today as America's worst prison fire. All this death and devastation happened in a cityscape that today holds swanky office space and manicured public parks. I'm talking about the Ohio Penitentiary. Most Ohioans today have never heard of it. Most Ohioans from days gone by knew it all too well. It was the first Ohio correctional facility to execute prisoners in 1844. It housed Confederate officers during the Civil War. Its infamous squalor and filthy conditions created the perfect brew for infectious disease that swept through whole cell blocks. But no story would top the catastrophic fire of 1930 that would entrap countless prisoners in their cells as they succumbed to the deadly smoke and flames. Despite the fact that many Ohioans are oblivious to this macabre history, there are groups that have worked to keep the lessons of the Ohio Penitentiary alive. The Columbus Landmarks Foundation is one such group dedicated to the preservation of Columbus's historic treasures. For a while, they organized tours of the Arena District, both informational and ghost tours. Their goal is to educate locals about the history beneath their feet. As I was researching the folklore around the Ohio Penitentiary, I had the good fortune to connect with two tour guides who had once led these tours, Dan Schneider and Nellie Campman. The first voice you'll hear is Dan's. He's a researcher who still gives ghost tours of various Ohio sites. Nellie's is the voice you'll hear second. She's the author of A Haunted History of Columbus, Ohio. She's a folklorist and a paranormal researcher. They both know the history and the lore surrounding this seemingly innocuous neighborhood in downtown Columbus. So lean back and imagine yourself walking through the Arena District with these expert guides leading the way.
Yeah, Dan, can you hear me?
Yeah.
How you doing?
Good.
The ghost stories that you've heard most associated with the Penn site, the actual penitentiary they built, that's mainly just the screaming and the burning flesh from the park.
The one I've heard repeatedly from, you know, people saying that this happens, and it's like, yeah, and it's supposed to be on the anniversary of the fire.
Okay.
Me and a friend of mine always talked about going down there near the anniversary or on the anniversary. Yeah, and we just never have. I found one story. I did the walking tour down there. You know, there's restaurants and shops and apartments and stuff, condos and the like. And I was, walking the route I was going to take, and there was an open house in one of the condos. I'm like, I'll check it out, see what it looks like. And there was the only person in there was a realtor, and I, told him what I was doing. I was research on the ghost tour. This guy didn't even realize this was the site of the old pen, which I thought was weird. But he's like, yeah, I haven't heard anything. Then before I left, he's like, you know, come to think of it, there was a lady in the next building, and she always said she would hear voices, and it was always guys saying they were hungry. And I realized that lady, I don't know exactly what unit was hers, but that building is located where the kitchen and dining halls were located.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And there was another story from someone that was a Columbus Landmarks member that told some of the people in Landmarks they had lived in the upper stories of one of the condos. And they ended up moving out because they would have stuff literally flying across their counters. Like somebody was throwing stuff in their condo. And apparently they weren't too excited about that and moved out.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Do you know where that would be on the map?
That one was around the, which would be the hospital building. I think it was in that one. That was the same building I went in and talked to the realtor.
Yeah, that's the one that goes along McPherson Park, right? Is the opposite side of that? Okay.
Yeah. And McPherson Park's just strange because the death house is right in the park. And the one time we were doing a tour, there's, you know, people out there playing. They were, you know, throwing frisbee and stuff and thinking, you know, many people died right in that area where you're playing frisbee. There's nothing marking where the death house was. There are some remnants around of the pen around the site at North Bank Park down along on the south side. There's a series of retaining walls and stuff along the path, and those were made from the stone of they recycled the stone of the penitentiary. There are also some of the buildings in the arena district reused it. There is up in front of the arena, there's a couple series of buildings and there's some alleyways. And one of the alleyways, there's some gates that are used as a trellis along one of the brick walls. And just recently, apparently they nationwide, I guess they were the ones that were in charge of demoing it, and they took all the stone and moved it off site, but nobody really knew where it was moved off site to. But it came to light not too long ago. It was actually in the Columbus Dispatch on the 18th of this month that it was moved to the site where they were putting the Crew Stadium just north of Nationwide Boulevard, and kind of, I guess it'd be northwest of where the site is, because they had to relocate it because they're building the stadium and there was still quite a bit of stone. They're hoping to reuse the set some capacity when they build the new soccer stadium.
So those are some remnants of it that remain there today, if you know what you're looking for.
Yeah. I know there's a walkway in North Bank Park. There's some infographic signs talking about some things in the area and some about the pen and stuff. And I believe it mentions the stones or stonework. The stone wall, retaining walls, sea walls are from the pen. I know the grates, there's nothing on there. If you didn't know it, if someone pointed out to you, you wouldn't know.
So can you tell me what got you interested in the Ohio Penitentiary in particular? I know that you have such in-depth knowledge on a lot of different legends in and around Columbus, but what was it about that area that drew you to it?
Well, my dad's business was downtown, and costuming, it was always busy season during October, and my mom would have to go downtown with them and work most of the month, and they'd take our kids along with them, so they wouldn't have to worry about getting a babysitter or anything. And we always went past the Belmont Casket Company, and then right beside that was the Ohio Pen. And this place back in the 60s was like the creepiest looking thing you can imagine. For some reason, it always seemed to be raining on days when we went down there, too. I'm not really sure about why that was, but it really was atmospheric, and it's kind of hard not to be curious about it.
Sure. I've seen pictures, but I'm sure that doesn't quite do it justice, but it looks a bit like a castle, right?
Kind of, a little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, looking at it from like a seven-year-old perspective, I had closest thing you could compare it to.
And with it being next to a casket company, that adds a little extra spookiness.
Oh, yeah.
I would think. It kind of loomed large just in your awareness when you were a kid and in and around the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so how did that eventually lead to you? You've given some tours in the area?
Yeah, for a long time there, I was a volunteer with the Columbus Landmarks Foundation. They do a bunch of ghost tours every October. They're like the oldest place in Columbus that's been doing tours. They've literally been doing them since like 1985. And Dan Schneider and I were asked to start leading some of the tours, so we put together a tour on the Ohio Penitentiary.
What kinds of tales do you often share with your tour people?
One of the big things that happened there was in 1930, they had a huge fire.
Yes.
That killed 322 people. And one of the stories about that is that, you know, sometimes people will be walking by and they'd hear the screams of the people or the men who died in the fire. The circumstances with that are pretty grisly. I mean, the warden, for some reason, did not order that they be released when the fire started. And the chief of the guards, he basically said, okay, we're not going to open up the place. We're just going to, you know, wait until we get some orders to let them loose. So many of them died from smoke inhalation. Some of them, you know, ended up getting burnt to death. And it was just, I can't even imagine being locked in a jail cell, just waiting to be let out, knowing that, you know, you're slowly dying from all that smoke and nobody will do anything about it.
Yeah, that would be horrific.
Eventually it came out, a few prisoners said that they had started the fire. But one of the theories about it was that, you know, that wasn't really true. It was really the revenge of ghosts who had been buried there in the olden days. Apparently the cell block that was burnt down was built on top of the old prison burial ground. And in Columbus, when they decide to build something over top of old graveyards and whatnot, they're not always that great about getting all the bodies out. Although it's very strange that the Belmont Casket Company, I had an acquaintance who used to work there as a security guard after they closed as a factory. And he said that anytime they were doing any kind of digging around there, they would find these bodies that were cut in half and buried upright. So I always figured that was where the burial ground was. During the late 1840s, 1848, there was a really bad cholera epidemic that it hit the pen so much worse than the rest of the city. And it was pretty bad than the rest of the city. During the worst of it, they had like one prisoner dying every hour. And I can imagine that they were just so overwhelmed with bodies that, you know, they might have tried burying them in a way that was rather dense. But I can't even imagine, you know.
So there's been all kinds of tragedies and lots of ghosts who linger, if you could imagine. Right?
Actually, an acquaintance of mine had a neighbor who lives in one of the condos that is built on the site now. And she lived on the top floor. And she kept hearing people walking on her roof at night. But there wouldn't have been any reason for anybody to actually be up there in the middle of the night. So that creeped her out enough that she ended up moving away.
She could hear people walking on her roof. That would be spooky.
These claims of paranormal activity aren't the first ghostly tales to come out of this location. For as long as the Ohio Penitentiary existed, so did stories about the unearthly prisoners who haunted the premises. One woman, Miss Jeanette Quakenbush, authored the Columbus, Ohio Ghost Hunter Guide. This reference compiles some of the paranormal claims that have been reported in the Arena District over the past couple centuries. When you consider the countless tragic deaths that occurred there, it's not a stretch to think that some souls might have gotten stuck between this world and the next. The most common claim is from unsuspecting motorists who park their cars in the multi-story garages. They step out of their vehicle, only to hear disembodied shrieks of men being burned alive in their cells. Others report smelling the scent of charred flesh and burnt timbers. Some have even claimed to spot full-bodied apparitions, men dressed in prison garb, roaming what was once the prison yard. One well-publicized account of a ghost sighting was included in a newspaper editorial of the Hillsboro News-Herald, February 23, 1905. An African-American prisoner by the name of John Harris refused to enter the prison yard, having witnessed a full-bodied apparition on more than one occasion. Even though he had earned special privileges to move freely within the prison's walls, he refused orders to run errands across the prison yard. The apparition he'd been seeing bore the distinct likeness to a fellow prisoner, Tom Hale. The man had come down with some infectious disease and was sent to the prison hospital. He'd begged Harris to come and check on him, to make sure he was getting the care he needed. Even though the men weren't really friends, Harris nodded his agreement. The desperation in Hale's voice required it. But when it came down to it, Harris just couldn't go. The risk of infection proved too heavy for him. None could blame his decision to stay away from the infection-ridden hospital wing. Hale would die alone after only 2 days. And in the days that followed, Harris was stupefied on seeing Hale's transparent figure standing motionless in the yard, staring blankly at him. Does the ghost of Tom Hale still linger? Eager ghost hunters can look for him themselves. What once was a prison yard is now the courtyard for the Burnham Square condominiums. It's located in the center of the condominium units that flank it on three sides. It's lined with trees and park benches, much more inviting, I'm sure, than how it looked back in Hale's day. So now that we have a handle on the ghostly claims of this location, both old and new, let's look at the penitentiary's history, which is wide and varied. In 1893, the superintendent of the Ohio Penitentiary Schools, a man named Daniel J. Morgan, published a book called The Historical Lights and Shadows of the Ohio Penitentiary. Copies were sold for a quarter. For the first time, the general public got an inside view of what life, and perhaps death, was like inside the prison's walls. The book was endorsed by the warden at the time, E.G. Coffin, lending additional credence to its claims. In a flowery prose, Morgan laid out what he described as the greatest prison in the world. The book's introduction harkens back to the birth of the Columbus Correction System in the early 1800s. It started with a collection of jails and prisons built within what would become downtown. One of the early jails was first built as a two-story log stockade and was surrounded by whipping posts. The correction system at that time was focused more on punishment than rehabilitation. Corporal punishment was the norm, and it was meant to be viewed by the general public. Ostensibly, this served as a deterrent for those considering breaking the law themselves. In short, torture was not only sanctioned, but publicized. Prisoners of all kinds, men, women, children, Native American prisoners of war, had been lashed to the posts and whipped till their backs resembled raw beef. Then, they'd be forced to lie down on the ground as hot coals and ashes were poured into their fresh wounds. Not many survived this treatment. Nearby graveyards were testament to the many souls who met a grueling death in these early jails. Anguished, ghostly cries could be heard from these cemeteries, sometimes punctuated by a maniacal laughter. Some claim to see phantom lights hovering above the tombstones. Others claim to witness full-bodied apparitions appearing in blood-stained and ripped clothing. Even after public flogging became a thing of the past, overall conditions at the early jails and prisons remained dismal. Cells were unheated. Many prisoners were lucky to get straw mats to sleep on. Meals consisted of beans and bread. Filth was everywhere, and disease was rampant. Soon, the state came to recognize its need for a centralized prison, one that would house the growing number of prisoners. Thus, the Ohio Penitentiary was formally opened in October 1834. It's hard to imagine how prisoners felt on arriving at the towering limestone edifice, after having marched from various smaller and quite squalid, ramshackle jails across town. Did the imposing castle-like walls give the impression that the inside would be just as stately? Whatever thoughts they had about it, the deadly forces within would soon confront them. Multiple cholera outbreaks swept through the newly built facility, killing scores of men in one infestation. From 1849 to 1850, the disease was particularly virulent, sweeping through whole cell blocks. Symptoms would begin with diarrhea. With little in the way of sanitation, bacteria spread easily among the prisoners. Widespread panic erupted among them, as those still healthy prisoners recognized an inescapable fate. Men contracted the intestinal illness one by one. Guards abandoned their posts within the facility and took up positions outside the walls, guarding the gates from the outside. They left the prisoners to their own fates within. What meager medical services existed were easily overwhelmed with the sheer number of prisoners turned patients. In the chaos, the strict rules of the prison went lax, as survival became all that mattered. With no guards left within, prisoners could roam about the campus within the outside walls of the prison. Men were known to shout their pleas to the public, hoping those outside might hear them. They begged for the governor to intervene, but the unfortunate prisoners inside were largely left to their own devices. Some helped one another as best they could, even through the dying process. There were some accounts of heroic measures, of hardened men turned nursemates to their fellow prisoners. Although guards on the outside feared a riot, none ever came. Those that weren't already dying were mostly sick and exhausted, leaving no real threat of aggression. In 1850, the penitentiary held 581 prisoners. By year's end, cholera had claimed 116 of the weakest and most vulnerable among them. Among the dead included the few medical staff who valiantly tried to save them. This cholera epidemic was only one of many calamities to cause tragic deaths on a massive scale within the prison's walls. But one story, one that has nothing to do with death, is worthy of a mention, if only because it's a great story. A famous Confederate general, John Hunt Morgan, was once imprisoned at the Ohio Penitentiary. His tale could be the plot of a Hollywood blockbuster. It all started in the summer of 1863, when General Morgan and six of his officers had carelessly disobeyed Confederate orders and led a cavalry unit across the Ohio River into Indiana, and then later Ohio. He and his unit were finally seized by the Ohio militia at the end of their unauthorized raid near Salineville, Ohio, on July 26, 1863. It was the farthest north any uniformed Confederate officer had ever penetrated into Union territory, despite the fact that his entire campaign had been a rogue operation. Since the Ohio militia seized and detained him, and not the Union forces, Morgan and his officers were thrown into the Ohio Penitentiary. By the end of November that same year, Morgan had led an effort to dig a tunnel from one of his officers' cells to the inner yard of the penitentiary. Using a makeshift rope of bunk covers and a bent poker iron, the group scaled the outer wall at night. Morgan and three of his officers managed to flee to a train depot and board a train. As it was pulling into a Cincinnati station the next morning, they jumped from it. With the aid of Confederate sympathizers, they hired a skiff to take them across the Ohio River and into the safe haven of the state of Kentucky. In the decades that would follow, the Ohio Penitentiary would become known for its squalid and inhumane conditions. It was greatly overcrowded. For a fee, wealthy and famous prisoners were given large and well-appointed cells, a sign of the rampant corruption that existed among the administration. For prisoners who broke the rules, punishments were barbaric. There was the dunking tub, used to bring prisoners close to the point of drowning, and stretching rings. And to add to the absurdity, locals could pay an admission to tour the place to get their own first-hand look at the degenerates and reprobates who were tortured there. Some say that a society is best judged by the way it treats its prison population. By that standard, Ohio was in the Dark Ages. Despite this dark history, nothing would compare to the catastrophe that destroyed entire sections of the Ohio Penitentiary on April 21, 1930. A conflagration would light up the night sky for miles. Screams of men dying in the flames could be heard for blocks. Men suffocated in the thick smoke. They burned alive in their locked cells. Some were burned so badly that coroners were unable to make an identification. Before the last flame would be extinguished, 322 lives would be lost. The Ohio State Fairgrounds would be turned into a makeshift morgue to accommodate all the human remains in need of processing. Undertakers from around the state would come to offer their services. When the blaze began about 5:30 that night, some guards ran in a panic before freeing the prisoners in their cells. By contrast, other guards rushed into the burning cell blocks. They fumbled with huge key rings, searching for the right keys for each unique lock as the inferno raged. Prisoners who were known violent felons made heroic efforts to save unconscious men, carrying them over their shoulders. Other prisoners proved vicious. Some were known to cut fire hoses and throw stones at those attempting rescues. Local hospitals became quickly overwhelmed with victims, but many victims had no need for a hospital, having succumbed early to the smoke and the flames. Many bodies would end up in the prison yard. In a morbid and ironic twist, their charred remains would become soaked. Water runoff from overflowing gutters could no longer hold the water that blasted from the firefighters' hoses. In the immediate aftermath and investigation of the fire, it would be discovered that many guards were more concerned about a possible prison break than the risk posed by the fire, and thus they refused to let the prisoners out of their cells. For some guards, by the time they realized the gravity of the situation, the flames had grown too large and the smoke too thick to risk freeing the men from individual cells. They could hear the men screaming to be let out. Some watched as the men were burned alive. Most guards would later plead that they were caught in the confusion and the chaos of the fire as it spread faster than anyone could have imagined. When firefighters arrived, some of them braved the flames and took to individual cell locks with axes and were able to free a lucky few. And when those firefighters exhausted themselves, one fire captain turned to a group of prisoners gathered in the yard and asked for fresh men to continue the rescue efforts. Nearly 80 prisoners volunteered without hesitation. Once the fire was finally extinguished, an initial investigation began. Corpses of men in their cells were found in a number of grisly circumstances. Some had stabbed themselves in an attempt at suicide before the flames could get them. Some had wrapped their bedding around their heads, trying to filter out the deadly smoke. A few were found with their fists still closed around the bars of their cell as they lie face down on the floor. Meanwhile, out in the prison yard, the survivors of the fire began to grow restless. The group was traumatized, and the prison administration had nowhere to contain them. Two companies of the U.S. Army and 1,500 Ohio National Guard troops were stationed at strategic places throughout the penitentiary. When surviving prisoners were ordered into remaining buildings that weren't touched by the fire, they refused. Many believed another fire might start. They remained in the yard, alongside the corpses of their fellow prisoners. This tense period remained until small groups of men slowly complied with the orders. By midnight, all survivors had been removed from the yard. On the outside, a crowd of onlookers was gathering. The blaze could be seen for miles, and the billows of black smoke and sirens were impossible to ignore. Extra Columbus police officers had to be called in to try and contain the surge of the crowd pressing in. They soon became overwhelmed, and the troops that had initially been called to keep the prison secure was now charged with the responsibility of pushing back the locals. With fixed bayonets, a company of soldiers pushed into the throngs until police lines could be established a block from the prison in all directions. Once that awful night had passed, it was time for the full investigation to begin. In the months that followed, state prosecutors proclaimed that they had identified a group of seven prisoners who were responsible for starting the fire. The story pieced together by investigators went something like this. The group had made plans to set the fire at 4:30 p.m. that day, a time when men were out of their cells and in the mess hall. They'd set the fire to the roof of the K-cell block, which was unoccupied at the time. They'd used oil-soaked wood forms confiscated from a construction site, which were highly flammable. Candles were used to ignite it. The arsonist hadn't considered that the fire might not take hold right away. They also hadn't considered that the blaze could spread to other occupied cell blocks. As it turned out, the blaze took an hour to get going, and by that time, the men had returned from dinner and were locked in their cells. The initial plan had been to stage an escape in the chaos that would follow. Investigators also claimed to have found the ingredients for nitroglycerin stashed in one of the arsonist's cells. They believed a second stage of the whole plan was for the group to blast a hole in the outer wall to allow for a mass prison break. The criminal litigation took years. Some of the original group of seven prisoners had cooperated with the prosecution and turned state's evidence. In the end, three men would take plea deals for the arson, copping the second-degree murder and life in prison without parole. They confessed that they started the blaze in an attempt to stage an escape. They also did the deed to protest being used as slave labor for building new cell blocks. It was the construction materials that served as the incendiaries. 2 years after the blaze, only one of the three men remained alive. Two of them that were accused of splitting the kindling for the fire hung themselves in their cells with their own bedsheets. It's hard to imagine the hatred they received from other prisoners as they went on living in the same prison where they had caused so much death and destruction. It was reported that they had pled with the state to execute them, and that a life sentence was given instead, a fate presumed worse than death. The only remaining convicted prisoner, Hugh Gibbons, had confessed to obtaining and lighting the candles used to set the blaze. He'd been kept in solitary confinement for 18 months following the fire. It was the only way of keeping other prisoners from killing him themselves. He'd been identified as the mastermind behind the entire plot. And you might think that this is the end of a grisly and tragic chapter for the Ohio Penitentiary. However, there's more. By January 1935, the man who had served as warden during the fire, Mr. Preston E. Thomas, had been suspended from his role. He had come under investigation himself. National Guardsmen had taken control of the penitentiary upon his forcible removal from office. He was escorted out of his private residence by armed guardsmen. He was only allowed to take his tobacco pipe with him, as the investigation included his 30-day suspension and a search warrant of his home. The charges, initiated by Governor Martin Davie, included corrupt practices like showing favoritism to certain prisoners, punishing other prisoners who testified against the state's interests, and failing to discipline guards who routinely showed up to work intoxicated. Warden Thomas denied all charges, claiming it was the governor playing politics, plain and simple. The bigger charges, however, harken back to his management in the fire that had taken the lives of 322 people. Years had now passed since a group of prisoners had been convicted of setting the blaze. However, new evidence had been surfacing, pointing to Warden Thomas himself. Prisoners had come forward claiming that the whole story around the fire had not yet come to light. The accusations were that Warden Thomas had ordered guards not to open the cells, fearing it was a prison break. It was also claimed that Warden Thomas had unlawfully punished prisoners who testified for the defense in the criminal trial. Many believed that the fire actually had been caused by shoddy wiring in the roof of the K-cell block. Claims of poor maintenance of the buildings and rampant corruption had been surfacing over years prior to the fire. The theory went that the group of prisoners eventually convicted of the arson were actually tortured and extorted by Warden Thomas himself. Many believed they had been forced to take the fall for the whole thing at the warden's direction. Warden Thomas would resign his position within a few months. In return, the prosecutor agreed to drop charges and the investigation against him was ended. He was given a full severance and pension benefits for his 31 years of service. The actual circumstances surrounding what caused the biggest and deadliest fire in American penal history remains uncertain. In the decades to follow, the Ohio Penitentiary would serve as the setting for a number of other bigger-than-life stories, like the time in the 1950s when an immunologist injected unwitting prisoners with HeLa cells. The aim was to determine whether this cancer-causing agent would act as a vaccine for these unfortunate men. The outcome of these rogue practices is unknown. Then there was the case of Chester Himes, the renowned African-American crime novelist who wrote his masterpieces from within his cell there at Ohio Penitentiary. And let's not forget Sam Shepard, the prisoner who served as the subject for the acclaimed movie, The Fugitive. The real-life neurosurgeon had been falsely convicted of killing his wife. He served 10 years at the Ohio Penitentiary before his exoneration in 1966. There are so many stories of the Ohio Penitentiary that could serve as podcast episodes within themselves. But I don't want to close this episode without going into some depth about the riot of 1968. There were many riots at the Ohio Penitentiary throughout its operation of about 150 years. But on August 21st, 1968, prisoners staged a riot that would last 28 hours. By the time it was over, five prisoners would die. 11 were wounded, and their demands for prison reform and improved living conditions would go unanswered. Their demands included basic improvements in living conditions. The sweltering heat of that August proved nearly unbearable. They asked for electric fans for their cells. They asked for medication that had been in short supply for sick prisoners. And they asked for, of all things, coffee. They also wanted 54 inmates who had been involved in a previous riot to be released back into the general population. They alleged being mistreated by 12 guards they labeled as sadistic and asked for a full investigation of the prison by federal authorities. In response to these demands, the National Guard blew a hole in the outer wall with explosives. They swarmed in with riot gear and shotguns. Remarkably, nine guards that had been held hostage were unharmed. When interviewed later by the press, these guards had believed that they would be killed before the riot was over. The prisoners who started the riot surprised everyone when they surrendered after the National Guard breached the wall. In the end, the five prisoners who died were determined not to have been directly involved in the riot. It's unknown whether the reforms the rioters had been asking for were ever addressed by prison authorities. The buildings that once constituted the Ohio Penitentiary were completely demolished in 1998. The prison had sat dormant and unused since 1984, when it was finally closed due to overcrowding and deteriorating conditions. The state of Ohio sold the property to the city of Columbus in 1995. For a time, it had been used as a haunted Halloween attraction during the fall months. Preservationists had sued the city in an effort to save the buildings for historical purposes, but ultimately failed. The Columbus Landmarks Foundation, mentioned earlier in this podcast, were listed as one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. In the end, interest to redevelop the area for the commercial purposes it now serves today won out. The city's hopes of attracting an NHL team proved successful, and the neighborhood was zoned for commercial endeavors that would support a new arena. Having heard the tragic and gruesome history of this nearly forgotten piece of Ohio folklore, you might assume the penitentiary's demolition is a fitting ending for the story. How could something good come of a location that was known for so much misery and human cruelty over the years? Although the buildings have long been torn down, something of the shadow of this institution remains there. The tortured spirits, sometimes spotted in and around the arena district, suggest that some prisoners were never released. I hope this tale helps us see the value in our freedoms, many of which we take for granted on a daily basis. I hope it helps us appreciate the life we have, and the importance of making it worthwhile. That concludes today's episode on the Ohio Penitentiary. I hope you've enjoyed listening. If so, please rate, review, and subscribe to Ohio Folklore on your chosen podcast platform. Ohio Folklore is also found at ohiofolklore.com and on Facebook. And as always, keep wondering.